The headlines, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the alliance is looking to reset eastern defenses amid the conflict in Ukraine. Moscow says the latest expulsion of U.S. diplomats was a forced measure which came after Washington expelled 12 Russian diplomats last month. And Iran renews its call for an end to the Saudi-led aggression on Yemen as the war is nearing its 7th anniversary. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, NATO leaders are gathering today in Brussels for an extraordinary summit. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the alliance is looking to reset its eastern defenses over Russia's offensive in Ukraine.
We have increased our military presence in the eastern part of the alliance. The NATO leaders will today address the need for a reset of our deterrence and defense in the longer term. Putin has made a big mistake, and that is to launch a war, to wage war against an independent sovereign nation. He has underestimated the strength of the Ukrainian people, the bravery of the Ukrainian people and the armed forces.
NATO leaders are expected to address different aspects of the conflict. Among the main topics are strengthening battle groups in several member states, increasing support for countries under pressure because of the Ukrainian crisis, as well as China's role in the ongoing developments. U.S. President Joe Biden is in the Belgian capital as well. He's going to address G7 leaders and meet with EU officials. Meantime, the U.S. is set to introduce a new package of sanctions on Russian political figures and oligarchs today. Tensions are growing between the United States and Russia over Ukraine. The Kremlin says Moscow's recent expulsion of U.S. diplomats was a forced measure. The U.S. Embassy in Moscow has received a list of its diplomats who were declared persona non grata. This after Washington said last month it was expelling 12 Russian diplomats at the country's UN mission in New York over national security concerns. Russian media say Moscow's expulsion of the U.S. diplomats was a retaliatory move. The U.S. Department of State says Russia's latest measure is unproductive and unhelpful. Fred Weir is a writer and political analyst. He says relations between Moscow and Washington have been on the decline since 2014.
Well, it's basically been in free fall since 2014. I've lost count of the numbers of tit-for-tat diplomatic expulsions. This, of course, every time we say it just can't get worse. And it does. And now it's just catastrophically terrible. I don't think that there's anything productive in these expulsions. I mean, I agree with the U.S. State Department on that point, except that they're doing it. They're finding new ways to hit at Russia. And this is in every way a war, except that there isn't direct contact between NATO and Russian forces. And let's hope it stays that way, but in every other way, they're at war. And this expulsion of diplomats from the UN, it's absolutely unprecedented thing. It's supposed to be illegal, but they did it. So how are the Russians to respond? I guess they respond by expelling an equal number of diplomats from the already skeleton crew at the U.S. Embassy here in Moscow. So will that help anybody? Will that improve the chances for dialogue, especially if it becomes urgently needed? Of course not.
Western governments are flooding Ukraine with more military and other types of support amid Russia's military operation. Britain says it will provide an additional 6,000 missiles. According to the Office of Prime Minister Boris Johnson, London will also provide around $33 million in funding to the Ukrainian military. That's besides over $5 million to support the BBC's coverage in the region. Johnson will announce the measures at the summit of the NATO and the Group of Seven on Thursday. The Prime Minister has already pledged to step up military and economic support for Ukraine. Now, Germany is also sending 2,000 additional anti-tank weapons. It has already supplied 2,000 missiles and missile launchers. Russia and Ukraine have been engaged in talks aimed at establishing a ceasefire for days. Both sides say the negotiations are pretty tough, but Russia blames the U.S. for obstructing the talks and seemingly wanting the conflict to continue. As this report explains, Washington has made other moves that raise doubts about its stated willingness to end the conflict as soon as possible.
Almost a month since Russia's special military operation inside Ukraine began, talks between the two sides to broker a truce have yielded little. Kiev says the negotiations have been confrontational at some points, but it holds out hope for them to succeed. Over the past few days, diplomats have said some progress is made in the talks, but they leave much to be desired. Russia also says the negotiations are tough, but accuses the United States of hindering their progress.
Talks started. They are tough. The Ukrainian side, although it understands that some things need to be agreed during the negotiations, constantly changes its position, rejects its own proposals. It's hard to avoid the impression that our American colleagues are holding their hand.
There are other indications that the U.S. might favor a prolonged military conflict in Ukraine. Reports suggest that the U.S. has floated the idea that Turkey could send its Russian-made S-400 missile defense systems to Ukraine to be used against Russian aircraft. In response, the West would provide Turkey with American-made Patriot defense systems. But such a move would endanger Turkey's position as a neutral mediator of Russian-Ukrainian talks, which would most likely derail the peace talks and undo any progress made during the negotiations. This essentially would mean turning the conflict into a war of attrition.
Quite frankly, I see it very unlikely that Western leaders have any real concern for the refugee and the migration crisis that the conflict between Ukraine and Russia is going to cause. You know, of course, the United States has a horrible track record when it comes to immigrants. We have the southern border of the U.S. with Mexico, where children have been in cages for two presidential administrations.
Washington hasn't formally asked Turkey to do so, but hasn't it considered the potential consequences of such a suggestion? Why would the U.S. want to drag out the conflict?
Well, Russia wants guarantees that Ukraine won't join NATO. It considers the eastward expansion of the military alliance a national security threat and its red line. Meantime, more NATO troops are being deployed to countries close to Russian borders, and the U.S. is not only earmarking billions of dollars in aid to Ukraine, but also planning to permanently station troops in Eastern Europe.
The U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price made comments earlier this week that indicated that Washington is trying to discourage Ukraine from making concessions in the talk with Russia, another factor that can prolong the military conflict. Dragging out the war and supplying more arms to Ukraine could turn the tides in favor of Kiev, but it would benefit the U.S. too. As an example, the U.S. and its Western allies have provided Ukraine with hundreds of American-made Javelin and Stinger missiles. To restock the arsenals, the Pentagon has asked American arms manufacturers to ramp up their production, which will only mean one thing: more profit for the U.S. military-industrial complex.
Well, I think it's very clear that the U.S. military-industrial complex has a vested interest in prolonging as many wars for as long as possible. We saw that in Iraq. We saw that in Afghanistan, and we're going to now continue to see that in Ukraine, because as the rather famous saying goes, war is a racket. And so when you have industries such as Lockheed Martin and Boeing that are producing billions of dollars worth of arms, airplanes, goodness knows what else, to then sell to the Ukrainians or give to the Ukrainians, they are winning so long as the war continues. No matter how many human lives it costs, they are still making a quick buck.
That could explain why the U.S. has allocated $13.6 billion in aid to Ukraine, half of which would go to arming the European nation and covering the costs of U.S. troops in Europe. The moves, which will surely be considered as a provocation by Russia, do nothing to end the conflict that the UN Secretary General has called unwinnable. One thing's for certain: the continuation of the conflict won't benefit Ukrainians that are caught in the crossfire, millions who are displaced from their homes, or the European nations that are hosting them.
Elsewhere, Iran renews its call for an end to the Saudi-led aggression on Yemen ahead of the 7th anniversary of an offensive that it's describing as a destructive war and a cruel blockade. According to the foreign ministry, Tehran backs any fair and practical initiative to end the blockade, establish truce, and launch talks to solve the crisis. In its statement, the ministry noted that any talks should be led by Yemenis and away from foreign interference. It also slammed the blockade on food, fuel, and other basic supplies into Yemen. It said the crisis is lingering due to Western arms supply as well as support for the aggressors at the UN Security Council. Since March 2015, the war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, either directly or indirectly. The UN says the war and blockade have pushed Yemen into the worst humanitarian crisis of the century. Foreign ministers from the Organization of Islamic Cooperation have met in Islamabad to discuss issues facing the Islamic countries. A two-day council of foreign ministers' conference discussed issues such as Palestine, Kashmir, and how to combat Islamophobia. Kamran Yusuf has the details.
This is the second OIC conference Pakistan hosted in 3 months. In December, foreign ministers from the OIC held an extraordinary session to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. But the latest session was a regular one with an ambitious agenda on the table. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan opened the conference while regretting how the OIC failed both the people of Palestine and Kashmir.
We have failed both the Palestinians and the people of Kashmir. I'm sad to say that we have been able to make no impact at all. They don't take us seriously. We are a divided house, and those powers know it.
For the first time, the Chinese foreign minister attended the OIC conference as a special guest. In his speech, Wang, he said Beijing wants to work closely with the Islamic countries.
China stands ready to work with the Islamic countries to actively advocate true multilateralism, safeguard the purposes and principles of the UN Charter, uphold the UN-centered international system.
The issue of Ukraine also came up for discussions. The OIC Secretary General stressed the need for a political solution to the crisis, as he feared the conflict would endanger international peace and stability. The OIC conference coincided with Pakistan Day celebrations. The delegates also attended the National Day parade.
The two-day conference concluded with OIC members adopting over 100 resolutions. But observers believe that Islamic countries representing 1.5 billion people need to make a difference through actions, as mere statements are not enough. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
South Korea says its northern neighbor has fired an unknown projectile, which may be an intercontinental ballistic missile. Japan has also confirmed the launch. It says a projectile traveled more than 70 minutes before falling in the Sea of Japan. Tokyo and Seoul say the missile, which landed in Japan's exclusive economic zone, flew higher and further than the ICBM Pyongyang test fired in 2017. They say it might be the largest intercontinental ballistic missile North Korea has ever tested. Japan and South Korea have censured the launch as a breach of the UN Security Council resolutions. The U.S. has also slammed the incident, calling it a brazen violation of multiple UN Security Council resolutions. Meanwhile, South Korea's military says it has fired several types of missiles in an immediate response to Pyongyang's alleged test fire. North Korea has yet to confirm the launch. Less than 2 weeks ago, Pyongyang fired a similar projectile that reportedly failed right after launch. North Korean officials say the last missile tests are carried out amid provocative and destabilizing moves by the U.S. and its regional allies on the Korean Peninsula. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, has more to tell us about North Korea's latest launch. Let's take a listen.
Well, North Korea typically does not comment on its tests until the day after the test, and it described its recent tests as launches of a spy satellite system to watch South Korea and U.S. military drills and military movements, because the U.S. and South Korea hold regular drills to practice invading North Korea. And furthermore, the South has just elected a new president who says he's justified in launching a preemptive military attack on North Korea in the event that he thinks that an invasion by North Korea of the South is imminent. So this means that the North has to do something to defend itself. Now, the U.S. claims that this is not a spy satellite that they are launching repeatedly, that this is a series of tests to perfect a new ICBM, the Hwasong-17, which is a huge ICBM armed with multiple nuclear warheads that can strike any U.S. city. This is their first ICBM test in more than 4 years. And this test was clearly a big success. It flew further and it flew higher than the previous Hwasong-15 test in 2017. This reached an altitude of 6,000 kilometers and it flew 1,100 kilometers, landing in Japan's exclusive economic zone. The U.S. is worried because this latest test was such a big success.
Let's wrap it up.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This March, 26 marks the 7th anniversary of the Saudi invasion of Yemen, which commenced in 2015 at the orders of then 29-year-old defense minister and deputy crown prince Mohammed bin Salman. In this regard, Kevin Barrett, a political analyst, has written an article entitled 7 Years of Saudi War Crimes and Defeats in Yemen. Stay with us for more. The Clown Prince, as he is sometimes called, had no military experience whatsoever and no qualifications for the job of defense minister, aside from his dubious pedigree as the scion of a notorious family of bandits. Nonetheless, this arrogant, reckless, supremely unqualified individual managed to insinuate himself into the Saudi military establishment, where he emerged as the leader of those pushing for war in Yemen. Bin Salman and his psycho fans insisted that they would score a quick and decisive victory. But disillusionment soon set in. Even Western sources were calling the Saudi campaign a quagmire as early as 2015. Now, 7 years later, the death toll is approaching 400,000, the vast majority civilians. The United Nations asserts that 225,000 Yemeni children under 5 have died due to starvation and preventable diseases. Most of those deaths can be attributed to one man, Mohammed bin Salman. Years ago, in 2018, the British Guardian accused MBS of war crimes, saying he persisted in waging war using methods that had the predictable effect of depriving millions of people of food, clean water, medicine, and other basic necessities. Bin Salman's actions amount to the use of starvation as a method of warfare which is prohibited by the Geneva Conventions, the Rome Statute of International Criminal Court, and UN Security Council Resolution 2417. MBS has resorted to mass murdering the civilian population of Yemen because he has had no success against Ansarullah forces and their allies. The Saudi debacle is astounding in light of their lavish military spending, which at nearly $60 billion per year is roughly tied for fourth place globally after the US, China, and India. Additionally, the Saudis have garnered at least nominal support from coalition partners including the UAE, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Sudan, Egypt, Jordan, and Morocco, alongside lavish military aid from the US and UK. How can such a massively funded and armed coalition possibly be losing a war against an adversary that is so much weaker on paper? The answer, of course, is that wars are not fought on paper. They are fought by human beings. And those human beings who know they are fighting in the path of God in self-defense with justice on their side are capable of defeating much larger, better armed foes. The Ansarullah forces and their allies have exceeded expectations almost as widely as the Saudis have fallen short, scoring victory after victory while displaying amazing courage and creativity. The entire so-called Saudi coalition is really just a gang of mercenaries, none of whom deeply believe in the cause they are fighting for. Even the handful of Saudi nationals involved in the war are afraid to get too close to any actual fighting. Saudi bomber pilots, who couldn't keep their planes in the air without massive assistance from the US, insist on flying at extremely high altitudes to minimize their chances of being shot down. That means their inaccurate bombs fall mainly on civilian populations while doing little damage to Yemeni military forces. The tens of thousands of foreign mercenaries the Saudis have shipped in from Colombia and other countries, as well as impoverished coalition partners like Sudan, are even less committed to the cause. The mercenaries' goal is to survive, to collect a paycheck, not to win. No wonder Ansarullah has repeatedly routed much larger and better armed enemies. Ansarullah appears to be reasserting control of Harav, a strategic city just a few kilometers from the Saudi border. The Saudis put enormous resources into bombarding and capturing part of Harav in a showpiece offensive whose apparent purpose was to generate a PR announcement. Hey, we actually want something for a change. But the victory was partial and short-lived as Ansarullah quickly re-established control, once again underlying the ineptitude of a Saudi military behemoth that cannot accomplish anything even close to its own border. Meanwhile, Ansarullah continues to showcase its increasing ability to take the war to the territory of its enemies. On January 17th, Abu Dhabi and Dubai were simultaneously hit by an array of Ansarullah's missiles and drones, sparking an oil refinery inferno and demonstrating that UAE leaders cannot continue to massacre Yemeni civilians with impunity. Then on January 31st, the Zionist regime's president Isaac Herzog's visit to Abu Dhabi was disrupted by a Yemeni missile strike, a symbolic reminder that the Saudi-UAE coalition has become the junior partner of the Zionists. While Ansarullah is aligned with the overwhelming majority of the people of the region who loathe Zionism and despise their Zionist boot-licking rulers. Speaking of that so-called coalition, the two key financiers of genocide of Yemen, the Saudis and Emiratis, have been increasingly at each other's throats. The southern region of Shabwah has witnessed fierce fighting between the Saudi proxy militia, Islah, and UAE-backed separatists. It seems that when greedy oligarchs band together to prosecute an unjust war, they and their rival bands of mercenaries lacking a just cause to unite around will ultimately turn on each other. The Saudi fiasco in Yemen raises two questions. Will the Persian Gulf despots and their international oligarchs' accomplices keep digging themselves into an ever deeper hole? And will that hole become their grave?
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the ethical features of dining table. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the ethical features of the dining table. In today's lesson, we will talk about one of the ethical features, which is taking small morsels while eating, taking small bites while eating the food. And it is ethical to take a small morsel and to take a small bite while eating. Why? Because it is not good to have a mouth filled of food and try to eat something with a filled mouth. It is better and nice and ethical to have small morsels while eating. And if you want to be amongst those who eats food and who gives respect to the food, and they're even while they're eating food, they look gentle, it is better to take small morsels while you eat food. And unfortunately, we have seen this, that there are some people, when they eat, they think it is their last food. They think that they do not have anything, or they will not have food after it. And therefore, when you look at them while eating, you notice that they're taking big morsels or they're taking big bites, which is hard to eat. And obviously, you know, some drops of the food is dropping down from the mouth. And you can see that, what kind of feeling do you get about such a person? What kind of feeling does other people, when they look at that person, will have? Therefore, it's in the Islamic lifestyle, according to the Islamic teachings, it is said to be gentle and take small morsels while you eat. It is easy to eat and it looks gentle and nice, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the ethical features of the dining table, and we were talking about the feature which is referred to taking small morsels or small bites while you eat. The Prophet ﷺ has said that when you eat, take small morsels. And he said, صغروا زغفانكم, make small morsels while eating, or take small morsels while eating. فَإِنَّ مَعَ كُلِّ رَغِيفٍ بَرَكَةٍ. Why? Because with every single bite that you take, with every single morsel that you're eating, there is a barakah, there is a blessing in it. And this blessing and this barakah will bring a blessing in your life. Therefore, take small morsels so you can have more blessings from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So Allah can give you more blessings. On the other hand, it is said that the time that we spend on the dining table, it is not calculated in our life. It is according to the narrations. It says that when a person is sitting on the dining table and he's eating, Allah does not count this time as the time of his life. For example, if someone has lived for 60 years and Allah has ridden him for 60 years, the times which he spent in the food, in eating food, it is not calculated. So the rest of time is calculated. So maybe he lives practically for 70 to 80 years. So therefore, it is recommended to take small morsels. There are many, many benefits of it. And on top of that, a person who takes small morsels, it is easier for his stomach to digest it, and therefore he does not get involved into sickness, or he does not fall sick after eating, because he's taking small morsels, the things that he can easily can eat, and his the enough space is there in his mouth, and obviously his stomach can also digest it. So it is recommended highly to do so. Therefore, we need to pay attention to such thing, inshallah. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
in like steps with spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health.
In the limelight.
The number of competitive congressional districts is on track to dive near and possibly below the lowest level in at least three decades, as Republicans and Democrats draw new political maps designed to ensure that the vast majority of House races are over before the general election starts. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Reed Epstein and Nick Corazzaniti. The piece is titled, Taking the Voters Out of the Equation, How the Parties Are Killing Competition. In the United States, the number of competitive congressional districts is on track to dive near and possibly below the lowest level in at least three decades, as Republicans and Democrats draw new political maps designed to ensure that the vast majority of House races are over before the general election starts. With two-thirds of the new boundaries set, mapmakers are on pace to draw fewer than 40 seats out of 435 that are considered competitive based on the 2020 presidential election results, according to a New York Times analysis of election data. 10 years ago, that number was 73. While the exact size of the battlefield is still emerging, the sharp decline for competition for House seats is the latest worrying sign of dysfunction in the American political system, which is already struggling with a scourge of misinformation and rising distrust in elections. Lack of competition in general elections can widen the ideological gulf between the two political parties, leading to hardened state stalemates on legislation and voters' alienation from the political process. The reduction of competitive seats is a tragedy, said former Attorney General Eric Holder, who is the chairman of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. Eric Holder added, "We end up with gridlock, we end up with no progress, and we end up with a population looking at our legislatures and having this feeling that nothing gets done." He added, "This gridlock leads to cynicism about the whole political process." Both Republicans and Democrats are responsible for adding to the tally of safe seats. Over decades, the parties have deftly used the redistricting process to create districts dominated by voters from one party or to bolster incumbents. It's not yet clear which party will ultimately benefit more from this year's bumper crop of safe seats, or whether President Joe Biden's sagging approval ratings might endanger Democrats whose districts haven't been considered competitive. Republicans control the map-making for more than twice as many districts as Democrats, leaving many in the GOP to believe that the party can take back the House majority after 4 years of Democratic control, largely by drawing favorable seats. But Democrats have used their power to gerrymander more aggressively than expected. In New York, for example, the Democratic-controlled legislature on Wednesday approved a map that gives the party a strong chance of flipping as many as three House seats currently held by Republicans. That has left Republicans and Democrats essentially at a draw, with two big outstanding unknowns. Florida's 28 seats, increasingly the subject of Republican infighting, are still unsettled, and several court cases in other states could send lawmakers back to the drawing board. Democrats in New York are gerrymandering like the House depends on it, said Adam Kincaid. the executive director of the National Republican Redistricting Trust, the party's main map-making organization. Adam Kincaid added, Republican legislators shouldn't be afraid to legally press their political advantage where they have control. New York's new map doesn't just set Democrats up to win more seats. It also eliminates competitive districts. In 2020, there were four districts where Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump were within 5 percentage points of each other. There are none in the new map. Even the reconfigured district that stretches from Republican-dominated Staten Island to Democratic neighborhoods in Brooklyn is now, at least on paper, friendly territory for Democrats. Without that competition from outside the party, many politicians are beginning to see the biggest threat to their careers as coming from within. When I was a member of Congress, most members woke up concerned about a general election, said former Representative Steve Israel of New York, who led the House Democrats Campaign Committee during the last redistricting cycle. He added, now they wake up worried about a primary opponent. Mr. Israel, who left Congress in 2017 and now owns a bookstore on Long Island, recalled Republicans telling him they would like to vote for Democratic priorities like gun control, but feared a backlash from their own party's base. House Democrats, Mr. Israel said, would like to address issues such as Social Security and Medicare reform, but understand that doing so would draw a robust primary challenge from the party's left wing. Republicans argue that redistricting isn't destiny. The political climate matters, and more races will become competitive if inflation, the lingering pandemic, or other issues continue to sour voters on Democratic leadership. But the far greater number of districts drawn to be overwhelmingly safe for one party is likely to limit how many seats will flip, even in a so-called wave election. The parties are contributing to more and more single-party districts and taking the voters out of the equation, said former Representative Tom Davis, who led the House Republican campaign arm during the 2001 redistricting cycle. Tom Davis added, November becomes a constitutional formality. In the 29 states where maps have been completed and not thrown out by courts, there are just 22 districts that either Joe Biden or Donald Trump won by 5 percentage points or less, according to data from the Brennan Center for Justice, a research institute. By this point in the 2012 redistricting cycle, there were 44 districts defined as competitive based on the previous presidential election results. In the 1992 election, the margin between Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush was within 5 percentage points in 108 congressional districts. The phenomena of the two political parties using redistricting to gain an edge is as old as the Republic itself, but it has escalated in recent decades, with more sophisticated technology and more detailed data about voter behavior. Americans with similar political views have clustered in district areas. Republicans in rural areas and exurban areas, Democrats in cities and inner suburbs. It's a pattern that can make it difficult to draw cohesive, competitive districts. No state has quashed competition ahead of the midterm elections like Texas. In the 2020 election, there were 12 competitive districts in the state of Texas. After redistricting, there is only one. Though Donald Trump won 52% of the vote in Texas in 2020, Republicans are expected to win roughly 65%, 24 of the state's 38 congressional seats. Texas gained 2 seats in the reapportionment after the 2020 census. The Texas state legislatures, who control redistricting, shored up Republican incumbents, including Representatives Dan Crenshaw, Beth Van Duyn, and Michael McCall, but in doing so also drew safer districts for Democrats such as Representatives Colin Allred and Lizzie Fletcher. The fact that it's going to be harder for us to pick up congressional seats is a big concern, said Gilberto Hinojosa, chair of the Texas Democratic Party. Hinojosa added, that doesn't mean that we think that it's not important to mount challengers. It's just the reality that it's going to be harder. Democrats did the same where they could. Oregon legislatures took the state's competitive 4th district and turned it into a seat that strongly favors their party. The change was so dramatic that Representative Peter DeFazio, an 18-term Democrat, told reporters last year that he chose to retire because the district is now winnable by another Democrat. Redrawing Mr. DeFazio's district enraged Oregon Republicans. A lack of competition has unintended consequences. Without a competitive race at the congressional level, local parties are deprived of an infusion of money and organizing. Candidates for governor or senate don't benefit from being able to piggyback on the energy and activity at the local level. Anybody running statewide has to pull the wagon entirely themselves because you don't have competitive races going on locally, said Matt Engel, a Democratic activist in Texas. It can sometimes take years to see the full impact of eliminating a competitive district. 10 years ago, North Carolina Republicans took a battleground district in the state's western tip and, by slicing off a piece of the liberal city of Asheville, turned it into a district that John McCain would have carried by 18 percentage points in the 2008 presidential election. The incumbent centrist Democrat, Heath Shuler, retired rather than seek re-election in a district he had little shot at winning. He was replaced by Mark Meadows, who went on to be the founding member of the right-wing House Freedom Caucus before becoming the last White House chief of staff for Donald Trump, and a central figure in Donald Trump's campaign to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Just listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very noble tradition and hadith which has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam regarding taking back one's gift. Just by way of passing, we should say that it's not good to take back one's gift which he has given to somebody else. It's considered very bad. Let's look at what Imam Sadiq says regarding this. Imam Sadiq said regarding a man who goes out with charity to give it to a beggar only to find that he has gone. The Imam said, then he should give it to someone else and not return it back to his wealth. All right, so this is an interesting hadith, right? We usually think of the act of taking back one's gift as you go somewhere, you give somebody a gift, and then you take it back from him. You say, hey, I gave you this, but I need it. Can I please have it back? That's something very bad. But here, Imam Sadiq goes a step further. He says that, let's say that you go out of your home with the intention of giving something as charity to somebody else. But when you get there, let's say the person is not there. Let's say that you were walking on the street, you saw a beggar, he was asking you for some money. You go, you say, you feel, hey, let me give this guy some money. You go to the bank, you go to the ATM to pull out some money, right? And when you come back, you see the guy is not there. What do? Usually, most of us will say, oh, well, I guess it wasn't meant to be. You put it in your pocket or back in your wallet, or you spend it on yourself, right? The Imam says that, don't do that. If something like this occurs, go and find somebody else to give it to. But don't put the money back in your wealth. Don't spend it on yourself. Don't put it back in the bank. Go give it to somebody else who might be deserving of it. Right? The Imam considers this also to be an act of taking back one's gift. Not to the person, but you were wanted to give charity in the way of God and you're taking it back. Right? So this is a very practical spiritual advice that we can all learn from. In a similar tradition, which is a little more harsh and kind of conveys the extent to which, you know, this act of taking back one's gift is wrong and bad. In another tradition, the Prophet ﷺ says, "One who takes back the gift he has given is like one who swallows his own vomit." Wow. This shows you how really bad this is. You know, a lot of times it might have happened to us. We're almost like, you kind of, if we burp and something comes up and you swallow it back, what kind of feeling do we get, right? We all have experienced it, how bad it feels, right? Taking back one's gift that you've given almost resembles something like that, right? So maybe, you know, this is maybe goes back to another bigger problem in the sense that maybe when we're giving somebody to something and later on we feel, oh, we might need it. What are we going to do now? Right. So this goes back to the idea of the sphere of poverty, you know, lack of trust in Allah, lack of trust in God. You know, I've given this away and now what's going to happen to me? Right. So this could branch out from another, you know, more deeply rooted evil. And therefore, this is why this is so very bad. You know, and another, by way of passing, we should say that this, you know, giving gifts and stuff, these are, this is something good. And it's a general kind of, you know, custom and etiquette within Islam. So, you know, this also is connected with that. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at taking back one's gift from Imam, in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
From arms sales, the increase of soldiers, to what has been described as a controversial statements coming from Russia and the U.S. in terms of the accusations that it has leveled, the conflict in Ukraine is reaching new highs. At this point, some of the developments, it appears to be continuation of the talks being jeopardized, as the U.S. has said, as Russia has said, by the U.S. trying to come in and try to disturb that. Let's move on, however, and introduce our guest. Frank Emspach is a professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin who joins us from Madison. Also joining us, Marcus Papadopoulos, is a historian, political analyst, and author who joins us from London.